fantasy sports fans, and welcome to a podcast to be named later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell. It is Thursday afternoon, and of course, that means we're talking fantasy baseball today. Excited to do it. Again, every Thursday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, we talk a little bit of fantasy baseball with George Kurtz and Brandon C. Williams from RotoExperts.com. George is our closer guru. He covers the ninth inning for us. And then we bring Brandon in to cover the waiver wire and some of the hot and cold players and analyze what other owners are doing as far as adding players or deducting players and so forth. So we do that every single Thursday. Love doing that. Love having George on the program. So we're going to be talking about the closer situation here in just one moment. Strange thing that happens in New York to one of their top prospects recently. I think about the Yankees probably more often than I should because, A, I'm a Red Sox fan, and, B, I'm friends with George. So I think about the Yankees. George all of a sudden comes to mind. That's a disturbing thought in my mind. I'm trying to fix that. I don't know if drugs or alcohol need to be involved in order to prevent that from continuing to happen. But regardless, something happens in New York. I wonder about George, and something happened this week. Gleyber Torres is going to need Tommy John surgery. Now, Tommy John surgery isn't some rare, odd thing these days. I call it the Tommy John virus because it spreads so freely and so quickly and so often in the last few years that it feels more like a virus than some kind of rare injury. It almost seems routine now. But Gleyber Torres took it now to a whole new level. The Tommy John virus is spreading. A, it seems like it's happening a lot more frequently. So that's the first. That's the first test that this virus is spreading, is that it's becoming more common. But that's with pitchers. Then all of a sudden we start hearing about it coming to position players. And while it's not common for position players, it's not this freak thing that never happens either. Matt Wieters had Tommy John surgery. Kristen Vasquez up in Boston had a Tommy John surgery. And position players actually don't have all that great a track record of coming back from Tommy John. Pitchers, it seems like they have a perfect routine and everything, but we've had some situations where players don't necessarily come back as successfully. But Matt Wieters seems to be fine, and Christian Vasquez up in Boston has been fine from everything I can tell. I'm surprised we don't hear about Tommy John more often with catchers. They throw more often than pitchers. Now, granted, they don't throw curveballs. They don't throw with the max effort as often as pitchers. But catchers, 5 days a week, they throw 250 pitchers or something back to the mound every single day. They throw cannons down to the bases. But then Gleyber Torres, if I remember the news correctly, not only does he need Tommy John surgery, but it's to his non-throwing elbow. So the virus has decided, no, we're not stealing enough pitchers. We're not stealing enough position players. That I imagine that's going to spread. They're probably saying, wow, this is a growth market. We got to go over to the position players and start screwing over the league and start getting Manny Machado's and Mike Trout's on the DL long-term with Tommy John problems. But they decided, no, we're gonna leapfrog that for now, and we're going to go and we're going to actually attack non-throwing parts of the body now. So we're going to need Tommy John surgeries on thighs and shoulders and everything. I realize that's a stupid comment. But nonetheless, strange week. Strange week. Gleyber Torres, top prospect for the Yankees. It sounded like he was going to be promoted. Now he's going to be under the knife and coming back from Tommy John surgery. Very strange. Let me bring George Kurtz into the program. He writes for RotoExperts.com. He also appears way more often than he probably should be over at the Fantasy Sports Network. They just exploit his efforts and his talents to no end. He is a nonstop guy doing podcasts all over the place, radio, TV, writing articles and content. George, you are a busy man. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk some fantasy with us today. How's everything going with you?
Everything is going well. Just finished Old School Fantasy with Matt Modica and Corey Parson. We're talking a little football, and I get to talk a little baseball with you. Listen, my daughter's last day of school is today, so all is well.
Yeah, my niece and nephew's last day of school were last week and yesterday. I help out my sister with her babysitting. Now that they're on vacation, now that my sister is done with school because she was a teacher, I am no longer required to get up at 6:30 in the morning to take care of the monster. So I loved when school got out when I was in school. I love it more now because I no longer have to get up at 6:30 in the morning and help out with those kids, who I love, by the way. I love the kids. They're great. Getting up at 6:30 in the morning every day to take care of those little monsters is not great for me. But now your job gets tougher. My sister's job just got tougher. Mine got a lot easier.
Actually, I'll tell you the truth. Actually, my job gets easier. My kids are pretty self-sufficient, and they sleep. So I'll actually be able to sleep a little later. Once again, that old school fantasy on the Fantasy Sports Radio Network starts at 10. So now I just got to get up for that.
I remember that. You and your kids have one of the strangest, sleeping habits, hourly things that I can ever remember. And to be honest, I'm jealous because I'm a night owl. So I love the way you do it. But I remember we talked about how your kids would be up at, 3-4 in the morning with you hanging out and everything? I wouldn't quite go that far.
But, yes, my family, my wife works nights, so, and I'm a night owl like you. And so my kids, I guess, have grown accustomed to that. They're not up to 3 or 4 in the morning, at least extremely rare. But it's not unusual for them to be up at midnight. Listen, my younger one is 6. She's generally – she falls asleep by 10:30, 11. The older one, she'll be 11. She can go till about midnight, 1 o'clock, before she'll truly die down. And it's the summer. Truth is, as long as they're not making noise, not burning the house down, I don't care.
Yeah, I always found that interesting. I love that about my nephew, actually. He sleeps in until 10:30 in the morning sometimes. So even when I do have to babysit, sometimes I get to sleep in too. So I like that very much. But let's get into the baseball stuff of things now. We only got a few minutes with you here. Let me first ask you about trade ethics. I read a post on Facebook the other day posted by a friend, a fantasy expert, a female fantasy expert, which there aren't a whole ton of them out there. Let's call her Spicy. She's sassy. She's close with one of our other friends who's also a bit of a hot ticket. And she posted a comment about a trade that happened in her expert league. And since you're the closer guy and the reliever guy, I want to ask you about two questions. One, the merits of the trade on its own. The trade was Hector Neris for
Conley, I know.
And so that in and of itself was an interesting trade. At first, I wasn't a huge believer in it, and then as I looked at it a little bit more, I was intrigued by it. But I want to ask you, in a yearly league, the merits of that trade, and then B, one of the things that seemed to really have her heated was that the owner who traded away the closer in Neris for Canley, the really good reliever, was that he had said that he wanted to help the owners beat another owner. Now, that may have been said in jest, it might have been joking, it might have been snarky, or it might have been serious. I don't know. I didn't read through the post enough to know exactly, but does the motive on why an owner does trades, in your opinion, ethically matter? Collusion, you shouldn't – absolutely is wrong. You shouldn't be cheating to thwart the league or anything like that. But if a trade is fair, does it matter that one owner is maybe doing it with motives that aren't exactly pure? Again, as long as they're not colluding, as long as they're not cheating, and as long as the trade is fair, does it matter that he wants to help one owner over another?
No, it doesn't. I don't play in this league. I know about this trade, and I was actually asked my opinion about this trade from one of the participants. And this, I didn't know about any motives, by the way, anything that was said as far as wanting to help the owner. But I was asked about did I think the trade was fair, Neris for Conley. And first thing I thought was, I don't care. I mean, it's Neris for Conley. Who cares? It's a minor trade. When did Neris become this lights-out closer? He's got 6 saves on the season. Philadelphia is terrible. They may not win 6 more games the rest of the year. I don't understand why anybody is mad about this deal because you're trading a technical closer for a non-closer. Conley will be the closer in a month. You know, Robertson's going to get traded. It could happen today, could happen tomorrow, could happen July 31st, but he's going to get traded. And then Conley's the closer there. You know, you can make an argument that Conley is more valuable than Neris right now if you don't need saves because he protects your whip, protects your ERA, and strikes out some batters. So actually, to me, this trade was like, who's complaining about this? You know, the people look at Neris' numbers. Before anybody complains, are you looking at the numbers for Neris? He has 6 saves. Why is anybody up in arms about this? You know, so that was my thought. This is a trade where if I saw it, if it happened in my league, I wouldn't give it a second thought. This is not something I would ever get my ire up. You know, regardless of what was said, that he's trying to help out another owner. Listen, I played in the league with you. I think you were in it at this time, where I was in something like second or third place, and it was a big league, 16 teams, and 2 owners were, I guess, negotiating a trade, and I guess one owner ticked off the other owner, where then that owner ended up making a trade with me and gave me a sweetheart offer. It was a fair deal, but it was a sweetheart offer, and I never even got involved in this, but because he was mad at the other owner, he made a trade with me, and I won the league partially because of this. And this is a long time ago, so when Manny Ramirez was still playing for the Dodgers, he's one of the players I acquired, and that's what happened. You know, and I didn't know about this. I didn't know about the fight between the other 2 owners until afterwards. But it does happen in leagues. And like I said, as long as the trade is fair and not collusion, I don't care. And like I said, this to me is silly that people are arguing over Neris for Conley, 2 guys that really right now just don't matter.
Well, you know, I'm not throwing out names because there's no real purpose in identifying the participants in this little squabble. But you know one of the people that is involved, and you know how close they are with another person who does not shy away from controversy. I imagine that's part of why this discussion is going on. Those two people that we are friends with, I'm not criticizing them. I'm not talking negatively about them. I like both of them. I've met them in person, actually, on a couple of occasions. I like both of them. So I'm not being critical or negative about them. But you know that they almost enjoy controversy. They love to argue and fight and pick fights and things like that. So that's probably part of it, right? You know who I'm talking about. You know what they're like. That's probably why this is going on at all. It's because that's just the way she is.
Yeah, I said it's silly to me. I think sometimes people look for a reason to fight and a reason to argue because they don't like a trade. This is Hector Neris for Tommy Conley. I mean, like I said, when I first saw this, when the person approached me about asking my opinion, I'm like, oh, good. This would be fun to sink my teeth into. Then I hear the players involved. I'm like, what? This is what we're fighting about? You know, I'm waiting to hear, like, Bryce Harper for Brett Gardner or something like that. You know, to hear this, and like, really? Someone's up in arms about this deal? Like I said, if I'm in a league with you, Chris, and you make this deal with, I don't know, Scott Engel, this is a deal I go, all right, good luck. I don't even care. I don't see this as being a deal maker, a championship maker. It's like Chris Middleton's not going to win the league now because he got Hector Neris. Why do I care? That's the way I look at it. To me, this is all about nothing.
Yeah, and actually, at first, my initial instinct was Neris is a closer, Conley isn't. I've heard that Conley looks good, but I haven't been following him closely. I don't play in leagues with holds. Middle relievers like Conley don't really come into my atmosphere or my orbit all that often. So my initial instinct was, I don't like that the owner had bad motives, but like you said, I'm a little less nonchalant about it. I would like owners to play purely and 100% above board, so I don't like owners being willing to help other owners, even if they're just willing to be fair about it. I don't like that, but again, I don't have an issue with it. There's nothing actually wrong with it. Forcing people to trade with people they don't like is stupid, let's face it. Telling people you have to make trades with owners that you don't like, or at least talk to them, that is an impossible demand. But in a perfect world, I would like all owners to talk trade with everybody, to do trades on the merits, and not want to help others. That's in a perfect world. But again, at the end of the day, as long as they're not literally cheating and the trades are fair, I don't see anything. You can't do anything about it even if you wanted to, and I don't see any real need that you have to. And then when I looked more at Conley, again, I've been aware of him, but I didn't realize quite how good he was. And then, of course, you say, okay, well, Robertson is going to probably be traded, and he's going to be the closer, and he'll be a better closer than Robertson probably. Again, you never know how a guy's going to handle the ninth inning as opposed to the eighth or the seventh, but he looks like he could become the next elite closer. Again, 50% of the closer situation, as you know, changes all the time, so he's as up in the air risky as the next superstar on the making. So, but the trade actually looks fair because Conley is better. The IRA and WHIP argument's a pretty thin one because we've talked many times, and Tony Sincotta has made this abundantly clear with me on multiple occasions, that they just don't impact those categories enough to make any difference or to justify any real strategy based on it. I've argued against that a little bit, but the fact is it's not like they're going to flip them unless it's an extremely, extremely close situation especially over an entire season. I guess in a one-week scenario in head-to-head leagues, it can maybe be a little bit, because if your reliever gives up six or seven runs in an inning and a third, that can be pretty punishing. But Canlay, that could be actually the guy getting Canlay, since he doesn't need saves, probably really did better. So the guy who gave up Neris, who's supposedly quote unquote possibly cheating, probably actually got the better side of this deal, because in 6 weeks or so, when Canlay is closing, if he's a stud, this is a guy who has saves already. He could trade one of his elite closers and probably get an elite player. So I'm actually seesawing the other way and saying not only was it a horrible trade, but it was actually probably a smart trade by the guy who was being accused of colluding. But anyway, let's get back to the ninth inning and get you out of here, Georgia. We talked about the trade deadline and guys moving. You just mentioned Robertson. As of right now, who are some closers that look like are absolutely moving and the guys that are possibly going to be filling those shoes?
All right, well, Atlanta can't be very happy right now, but Jim Johnson has struggled of late. I fully expect him to be on the move. I don't think he'll be a closer for his new team. I would expect him to be a setup man, but Jim Johnson is certainly somebody who I don't think will be in Atlanta long-term this season. I think Mauricio Cabrera could be the closer. Alvarado Viscano will be another possible chance there. Other closers that could be on the move, David Robertson, we all know he's going to get traded, just a matter of time. And we just mentioned Tommy Conley is more than likely the guy next in line, especially with Nate Jones still on the DL. That's something to look for there. Justin Wilson in Detroit, he could also be traded if Detroit falls apart come the deadline. It looks like Cleveland now is ready to run away with that division. So I wonder if Justin Wilson could be on his way out. If he is, I don't expect him to close for his new team. But the lefty specialist coming out of the bullpen. Who knows who closes for Detroit? K-Rod's terrible. I don't know if they would go back to him. Not unless they just totally don't care about the season. Kelvin Herrera, I think KC will move him if the price is right. But all of a sudden, this team is playing well again. Maybe they want to stick around for it. I think it would be a mistake if you're KC. You sort of have to trade these players. You cannot lose them for nothing. So I think that'll be interesting to see what happens there. The Angels, do they move Bud Norris? I think they'll keep Cam Bedrosian, but they could move Bud Norris. He played well. I think Bedrosian probably will stay at closer even when Norris returns, even though Bedrosian was in the seventh inning last night, first appearance back, seventh inning on Tuesday night. First appearance back from his DL stint. So it's an interesting situation in L.A., but I think Norris could be on the move as well. We heard rumblings that A.J. Ramos out of Miami could be had. I think that's smart of Miami. They need to rebuild, so Ramos would certainly help there. The Mets, whenever they finally decide to give up on the season, if they haven't already, Addison Reed could be on his way out. Once again, no really great guy to pick up when he's gone there. Oakland, Santiago Casilla, Ryan Matson, Axford, Doolittle, they could all be traded, and it wouldn't shock me if they all are traded, as this team needs as much help as they can get, and trading these guys would certainly be a good start for them. San Fran has said they will not trade Mark Melanson, which is no shock to us right now. What could you get for him? You owe him $50 more million on that contract, and he's terrible. So good luck there. If Tampa Bay does completely fall out of it, I think Alex Colome might be the best closer that could be available on the market, and he's someone that would probably have quite a bit of value. Not Andrew Miller or Aldous Chapman value of last season, but I think teams would be going out of their way to try and acquire him.
Of all the studs, last year, obviously, we saw Andrew Miller and Aroldis Chapman traded. That was a very unique situation with an organization that was in a very unique position. You don't usually see those guys. You mentioned Robertson. Is he the best closer that may be traded? You said Colome, but he's got some control under him. Any established studs that you are either concerned about because they're not pitching well, Edwin Diaz seems to have righted the ship, or studs that, other than Colome and Robertson, could possibly be on the move that wouldn't – maybe it would even be a surprise, but nonetheless a possibility.
I think Robertson is the best closer that is definitely going to be moved. We could speculate about Colome. You could speculate about a few others here, but Robertson's going to be moved. We know that. Once again, we're hearing Washington kicking the tires on him again. I think the Nationals, they know they need a closer. They probably need a closer and bullpen help. Hey, they know it. You know it. I know it. The league knows it. For some reason, the Nationals seem to want to believe, hey, maybe the price will come down by July 31st. That's not going to happen, and we all know that too. But the Nationals are in first place by 1,000 games. They can afford to wait if they truly believe the price might come down. So they can wait and see what happens here. I think that's what you're seeing there. But Robertson, I think, is the best closer that will definitely move. Colome, you mentioned, he's going to have a high price because of that control and because of how good he is. So maybe he doesn't move. Herrera, he's another guy who I like a lot, but maybe the Royals hold on to him because they're still technically in the playoff hunt here. I think it would be a mistake. I think the Royals know that. That they really can't afford to hold on to a closer. It's a luxury piece for a small market team. So he's another player that I do expect to get dealt. But there is always that possibility, 15-20% chance, that the Royals say, the hell with it. We're going to go for it again this season.
George Kurtz from RotoExperts.com. You can follow him on Twitter at George Kurtz. George, thanks a lot for your time. Enjoy your remaining summer and good luck with your family. And hopefully I'll be talking to you at 2 a.m. in the morning here in the coming weeks ahead. Thanks for coming on today.
Be good, bro. Enjoy your summer.
All right. That's George Kurtz from RotoExperts.com. Again, he's on the Fantasy Sports Television Network. He's on the Fantasy Sports Radio Network. He's talking, even talks hockey on a podcast. He joins these podcasts. He's everywhere talking sports. And I gotta say, I love talking sports. And I love talking with George. We've been doing these podcasts and things like this for years now. So George is a heck of a guy, not to mentioning the fact that he also knows what he's talking about when it comes to fantasy sports from all different angles. He knows all the different styles. Hockey, football, baseball. He doesn't cover basketball. He doesn't cover college sports. Doesn't follow golf. So I guess he doesn't do everything, but he does a lot. So he's on the program every single Thursday, and we got him out of here quick and easy. But good to talk with George. That's, again, over at rotoexperts.com and on Twitter, at George Kurtz. If you want to follow me, Chris Mitchell here, hosting a podcast to be named later, you can get me on Twitter at CJMitch73. You can read my content over at rotoexperts.com, minorleagueball.com, or you can talk with us on Facebook. We're more than happy to just sit around and be lazy and not do work. Mr. Trump wouldn't like that. I'm sorry, Mr. Trump, but from time to time, we'd rather talk sports than talk politics or actually be productive. So you can do that on Facebook, a podcast to be named later. And we also have the fantasy sports show page as well, the rotoexperts.com fantasy sports show, both of those on Facebook. Excuse me. So that's our first part of the day where we got the close a roll situation. And we've been doing it with George for the last few weeks. And some of the shows kind of overlap because they're while the closer situations are always in flux and there are some changes. He mentioned Jim Johnson struggling recently. He was relatively fine 2 weeks ago. Now he isn't. That's one of the reasons why we have George on, is that there are always a closers on the hot seat. It's coming and it's going. Some guys are on there. Some guys cooled. And then in the coming weeks, we're definitely going to be seeing some trading going on. And so we'll get into the rumors with him. But sometimes we go over topics that we've already covered, like Addison Reed and A.J. Ramos and things like that. That's obviously a wait-and-see scenario. So he'll cover those every single week when we talk with him. But don't be discouraged if you're hearing news that you already heard last week. Because some of these situations, they're simmering. They haven't happened yet. Now we're going to get to the closer, get off of the closer report and move on to the waiver wire with Brandon C. Williams, who's also now a guy that does everything. He covers more than George. He's not on the Fantasy TV network or the Fantasy Radio network, but he writes for a variety of different sites and also covers more sports than even George. I don't think he covers hockey, but he covers basketball now with a Canadian Football League, covers college football, covers baseball, and obviously fantasy football as well. Brandon C. Williams from rotoexperts.com. You can follow him on Twitter at BCWilliams71. Brandon, thanks for coming on today. It's nice and early down there in Texas. It's beautiful here. The weather is finally beautiful. I don't know why people don't want to live in the Northeast. They complain about the snow and the cold. But the fact is, as we get to now, I don't know how you guys deal with it. I mean, aren't you roasting in Texas and it's only June? How do you live in Texas in July? And I know you're out at the football fields covering high school football and all that stuff. So not only are you roasting like a peanut, but you're sitting out there simmering in the sun of those football fields. How do you get by living in Texas with all that heat?
Experience, my friend, experience. It's actually not as hot down in the Houston area. We actually had a tropical storm, Cindy, that kind of breeze through the area. East Texas and the good chunk of Louisiana got the bulk of it. We were expected to get about 3 or 4 inches of rain. Right now we've only had like a smattering of it, but the backlash will feel on Saturday when the temps go back to normal. We'll hit back into the mid-90s and it will feel like 100. So yeah, it's mid-June. We haven't even touched July. We have not even hit August. But that was part of the reason why, that was part of the reason why the Texans left to do training camp in West Virginia. Where they are in West Virginia, it's 82 degrees out there in July and early August, whereas in Houston, it's 94. And that's not counting the heat index. And I have been out on Texans practice field where it goes 9:30 in the morning. It's about maybe 94, 95 degrees, and that heat index has you feeling like 110. And I learned early on that, you know, you don't wear jeans out there to cover a Texas practice. That's a major no-no.
Yeah, I would think so. The only debate I would have is, do you dress up in loose shirts and bring a fan with you, of some kind of battery-powered fan, or are you allowed to wear shorts and kind of be all cool in the gang? Jeans would not.
Yeah, you can wear shorts.
I would either be dressy or comfortable. I would not be in jeans.
No. I learned that the first time I covered a training camp. I went out there, you know, jeans and a polo shirt, and probably sweat off about 4 pounds between both practice sessions. The thing that I've learned is that, stay hydrated most of all. Even in shorts, you know, it's going to burn up. And there were times where, you know, you sit out there for a 90-minute, two-hour practice, even with a cap, even hydrated and even in shorts, you know, the sun's going to take a toll out of you. But it's Texas, and it's one of those things where, you know, you kind of learn to live with it. You know, it's kind of like an extended summer with us, in the sense that, you know, when fall officially begins, we're still hitting about, say, the upper 80s and for highs. So we don't get much cold. But right now, yeah, we are about to hit our peak season. It's hot, but we really haven't hit what I like to call the blast furnace time of year, and that's usually the first week of July until about the end of September.
All right, we're going to be talking fantasy baseball here with Brandon C. Williams from RotoExperts.com. I was debating on Facebook the other night, late at night, of course, as I am a night owl, about prospects and their promotions and what you should be expecting from prospects and their promotions as rookies. And this one site that the one page on Facebook that I talk prospect from time to time, they follow prospects pretty closely. And as I cover them for fantasy sports and as well as for minorleagueball.com, which is where I post these podcasts, they get into the weeds of it. They really get close. They get even into the advanced metrics. And then they talk about some prospects that aren't that big of a deal. But we were arguing about Willie Adames, who Joe Galina over at RotoExperts.com, who also writes about prospects for us, commented on how he's – the headline, at least, says that he's ready to shine. Now, the headlines don't always tell the truth. Many, many a time I've seen a headline for my article, which I did not create, that really did not reflect any of my content in the actual article. So the headlines often are misleading or outright wrong. So I didn't read the article all that closely, but I did look at Joe Galina's analysis a little bit. And to me, Willie Adames isn't really all that great of a fantasy prospect, to be honest with you. But this one owner on Facebook really liked him and was really excited about him. And one of the things he was saying in a yearly league was the reason why he was considering trading a middle infielder because Willie Adames was probably going to be promoted in the next week or so. The Super 2 deadline seems to have passed. It wasn't announced that it's been passed, but once a certain amount of players have been promoted, the rest of the players are no longer Super 2 eligible. So there's no specific date that is quote-unquote the Super 2 deadline. It's a volume of players. When a certain percentage of prospects are promoted to the major leagues, then those guys are eligible to be potentially Super 2 players. The guys who come afterwards, therefore, cannot accrue enough, just can't become one. That's the loose description of what Super 2 deadline actually means. So we're going to see more and more prospects promoted now, one of them being Willie Adames. And he didn't want to trade a middle infielder because he was afraid that he was relying on Willie Adames essentially to help him this year. Now, I don't even think Willie Adames is all that great of a prospect as far as a fantasy prospect. He may end up being a nice baseball player because the standards for being a good baseball player and for being a good fantasy player, in some cases, there's no difference. In other cases, there's a pretty significant one. And in this case, I don't see Willie Adames being a very good long-term dynasty prospect because I don't see 20 home runs. I don't see 20 stolen bases. I don't see a 300 batting average. When a guy can't do any of those things, I realize shortstop's a thin position, so the offensive expectations are lower. I just don't see a great player. My question I want to ask you, because you're the waiver wire guy, and a lot of these prospects are going to start hitting the wire now. If they're not already there, they're going to be hitting it. They're going to be promoted soon. They're going to be contributing some way. When you look at a prospect on the waiver wire, what do you use to determine whether you think he's a good claim or a bad claim? What are your expectations? I find fancy people have, for the most part, ridiculous expectations. It's pretty rare. My problem is sometimes I'm overly critical and my expectations are too high, but I find maybe that's a backlash to the fact that everyone else expects so much more and they expect way too much. What's your thoughts on prospect promotions and how you determine whether you think they're a waiver wire darling or, you know, kind of a red herring?
To me, the one thing I do is that I try to come together with a reasonable comparison to a ball player at that certain position. I think that when you look at Willie Adames, I think the comp with me is Brandon Crawford of the Giants, which tells me that, you know, he's not, you know, a guy that you're going to tear the floors down to get. I think that Adames is going to be a good Major League Baseball player. I think that there's the potential for him to be a Gold Glove shortstop a few years down the road. But when I look at him in fantasy, I don't see anything exceptional about him. I agree with you totally. I think that this is a guy that is probably going to be high end, about say maybe a 275 hitter. He might have a double digit home run season or two, and he might give you around maybe 6 to 8 stolen bases. The on base percentage, you know, his OBP in the minors right now coming into today is 360. It's fairly good, but, you know, it's a 763 OPF, which tells you that, again, he's going to be a Carlos Correa-type shortstop. He's not going to be what a lot of people do at Gleyber Torres will be once he eventually comes up with the Yanks. So that's the one thing I look at when it comes to prospects. I try to make reasonable comparisons, and with that, I try to go with a high end on the, okay, suppose this guy just really does, you know, light it up. You know, when Lewis Brinson got called up a couple of weeks ago, you know, my high end for this guy was, you know, and flashing way back to my youth, kind of like a Cesar Cedeno type in the sense that, you know, I thought that I still think that Brinson could be a guy who can hit for average, he'll hit for power, you know, for stolen bases. I think that Brinson could be a 30-30 guy, but we're just got the temporary expectations for him this season. And when you look at the fact that his percentage of ownership is dropping because of a slow start, you're beginning to realize that. But when you look at Adames, he's a guy, again, I think that there's some talent there. I certainly do believe he'll probably be called up around after the All-Star break, probably like mid, you know, probably more later in July, depending on where the Rays are as far as chasing a wild card. But Adames is a guy I don't see being a fantasy impact ball player. I think that he'll come up, spend the remainder of the year in the bigs, and in 2018 when we start doing our tiers for drafting, I think he's probably going to be more closer to a low-tier two or maybe mid-tier three shortstop in the sense that he's not going to help you a lot, but he's not going to hurt you either. So when you have a guy like that, you know, you're just hoping for the best. And what he's doing in the minors really is about what you're going to see from him. You know, 270, four homers, 31 RBI, three stolen bases, 36 runs scored. If you prorate that to 550 at bats, you're looking at a guy, 270, about maybe 10 to 12 home runs, maybe about, say, 75-80 RBI on a good season, and about five or six stolen bases. So I don't really see a lot of excitement on my end for Adames, but I know that in deeper leagues, keeper dynasties, and AL-only leagues, his call-up is going to mean a lot more to them than it would to me in a basic standard format.
Yeah, when I look at prospects, if you want to try to keep it simple without getting into the weeds of it all, I look at impact tools, and then I look at whether statistics match those potential scouting report tools or if they don't. And another thing I look for is a dominant season. Now, these aren't laws, and Willie Adames maybe isn't a little bit of an exception, but he's never hit more than 10 home runs or more than 11 home runs in a season, and I think most of his seasons have been 8 or lower. I think he maybe had 11 home runs in one season. He's never stolen 20 bases in a season, and his success rate isn't actually very high. He only succeeds somewhere between 60 and 65% of the time, maybe even a little lower than that for his career. But even in his best seasons, he's only been successful like, you know, two out of three times, 66%, something in that neighborhood. So that doesn't bode well for a player for me, a guy who doesn't hit a ton of home runs and doesn't hit for a high average and doesn't steal a lot of bases, and he hasn't had a breakout monster season. And the scouting reports don't suggest he has a significant impact tool. So when you combine the fact that the statistics kind of reflect the scouting reports, that doesn't bode well, in my opinion. And yet you hear the conclusions. This is something that's difficult about prospects is you'll see prospect reports. And again, these a lot of times are looking at them as baseball players. So it's not their fault that the prospect reports say what they say, and then they come to a different conclusion than we do. I guess that's my point is, you'll see it like J.P. Crawford is the one that drives me the craziest, or Nick Gordon from the Twins. He was drafted. He's D. Gordon's, I think, half-brother or something. These guys sometimes, they're praised for their athleticism, but their tools aren't really all that loud, and they even speak about them in mediocre kind of terms, pedestrian kind of terms. And then the end conclusion after all of that mediocrity is, but this guy's going to be amazing. You know, this guy's a star in the making. It's like, and I look at Willie Adames and I kind of see that. I say, okay, the home runs aren't really going to be all that standout. He's not going to run. He's not going to hit 300. And yet you love him as a player. Where does, you know, meh plus meh equal woohoo? I just don't get it. And yet we see that a lot. The one thing with Willie Adames, it's a little unique, and we'll get off this topic and I'll ask you a couple more different questions, but The one thing about Willie Adames is he is only 21 years old, which my argument is that's not that young these days. It's still young, but it's not like it's that young. A lot of guys are being promoted at 21, 22, at late 23. Aaron Judge is a very old rookie based on today's world. And maybe not, you know, 15 years ago, 24, 25 may have been really when guys were promoted. That's not how the minors work anymore. These guys are drafted at 18, 19 years old, and 4 years later, they're supposed to be in the major leagues. That's probably expectations we shouldn't have on these guys, but that's just the norm. These guys are not spending more than 3 or 4 years in the minors at the most. So if you're drafting at 18, by 22, you're supposed to be in the majors. If you're a legit top-tier prospect, if you're just an also-ran, if you're a replacement-level guy, and those guys are valuable. In Major League Baseball, if you draft a guy that ends up becoming just an average player, that is a draft success. So even if you get a utility player or the 24th guy off the bench kind of guy who just plays defense and pinch hits, that's a successful draft pick if the guy becomes that. So we're talking about the high-end guys, the guys who are supposed to be difference makers. So for a difference maker to be in the major league by 21, 22, that's not that rare. It's not shocking anymore. If a guy's in the majors by 19, yes, that is still shocking. But by 21, it's really not. That being said about Willie Adames, it is still young, and maybe he is still developing, and maybe he's only hit 11 home runs in a season, but he's still young enough where there's still some maturity and development level coming. So he could become that 20 home run guy, and because he was younger than most of his competition at every level, the fact that he just was able to hold his own at a level where he's playing with guys 2, 3, 4 years older than him, that in and of itself is almost sort of like a breakout season. So it's a weird way to look at it. But if you're very young for your level, you're playing with a lot more mature, older players, and you're holding your own, that in some ways can be seen as success. Whereas when I'm looking at a dominant season, I want to see 20, 30 home runs. I want to see 30 stolen bases. I want to see him 370 and really demanding a promotion to the next level. That's what I like to see from a top-tier fantasy prospect. And Willie Adames just doesn't even come close to that. So I'm skeptical. But again, there's still room for him to make that next leap. And shortstops do that relatively not often, but it happens. Francisco Lindor, I didn't think he'd be a great fantasy player. I didn't think he'd hit for enough power. I didn't think he'd steal enough bases, though I thought that would be kind of a savior, is that he'd steal enough bases where if he just hit a few home runs and was a Gold Glove shortstop and therefore would stay at shortstop, he wouldn't move because being great at defense doesn't matter except for it forces teams to leave you at that position, and that's all I care about. And he's developed into more. Francisco Lindor hits for a lot more power than I ever thought he would. And he's stealing the bases, and he's hitting for the batting average. So Francisco Lindor developed into a much better player than I thought he would be. I thought he'd be a very good baseball player, but I didn't think he'd be a special fantasy player, and that's really not true. He really is an extremely good fantasy player now.
Oh, no, there's no question about that. I thought that Lindor would steal bases, and I was skeptical about the power. I did not expect that, you know, the power that we're seeing out of him would be at that level. I thought that he would be a guy that would probably come out around, say, 10, 15 home runs on a good year. But you're looking at a guy who, you know, could possibly hit 20 to 25 home runs, not only this year, but also on a consistent basis. And that's going to make him even bigger. You know, that's going to make him an even bigger asset in fantasy leagues. And it puts him, you know, almost on par with Carlos Correa when you look at the upside of each of these guys. All right, I remember the two of us talked about a year or so ago about, you know, who's got the bigger upside long-term as far as fantasy league shortstops when you looked at Correa and Lindor. And I kind of thought that, you know, maybe Correa had a slight edge because of the power potential, but now because of the fact that, you know, Lindor is flashing that pop, it's almost a dead heat.
Correa came down a little bit from his exceptional rookie season and his insane minor league career, and Lindor is actually exceeding expectations. I agree. They're getting a much closer. Corey Seager hit 3 home runs the other day. He doesn't steal them. And he may eventually move off shortstop, which I always thought Carlos Correa would. One of the things that I was a little bit skeptical about with Correa is that he should be playing third base. It's kind of like a Derek Jeter situation. He's playing shortstop because he's the superstar of the organization. but Alex Bregman is a better defensive shortstop. There are other guys in their system that if they wanted to promote him and use them, they would be better shortstops, and he should move. But it looks like because he's quote-unquote Carlos Correa and because he wants to be the shortstop, you could bring A-Rod there in his prime, and A-Rod is still going to play third base, and Derek Jeter is going to play at short. That's how I sort of see Carlos Correa, and I'm wondering what the Dodgers do with Corey Seager. How do you move a guy that, doing what he's doing offensively regardless of the defense? It seems like, you know, don't mess with it. You may not love his defense. You may think he's adequate. You may think he – until he's horrible at the position, don't mess with it because things are going good. So we'll see what happens with Seager. But it looks like Correa is a shortstop forever, so even though he should be a third baseman. Let me ask you about other prospects. I'm not going to ask you to speculate on guys on the rise, you know, that aren't in the majors yet. I'll do that for the listeners. But of the guys that are on the waiver wire – that either you're hearing rumors about, so therefore they become viable claims, or they're in the major leagues right now playing, but they're still available on the wire. Who are some prospects and rookies that you think can make enough of an impact where if they're on the wire, you should own them?
There are a couple of guys that, you know, you look at and say, you know, you can grab these guys on the edge of call up and then go with. I still think that when you look at Derek Fisher, he got sent down predictably earlier this week. Once Josh Reddick was recalled from concussion protocol, but Derek Fisher showed this brief time what he's capable of doing. You know, it's a limited set, so there's really not a reason to really, you know, go crazy about him. But from what you saw out of him, and he was the Astros' fifth-ranked prospect, you start looking at this guy and thinking, you know, once he comes back up, he's never going back down to the minors. You know, this is a guy that I think is going to be an impact bat once he's up in the majors for good. And, again, it just shows you just how deep the Astros are to the point where they're going to have to find room for a guy like Fisher in that lineup. You know, probably opening day right fielder, you know, in 2018. But Fisher is a guy that, you know, you certainly love. You know, he's still owned in 35% of CBS Sports League. So it shows you that people are going to hold on to him for that simple fact. A couple of other guys that are slowly coming up, obviously, Super 2 out of the way, you know, it only brings up the rumors that Yohan Moncada is going to come up at some point in time for the White Sox. I would venture that he will be up sometime in July. I would go ahead and be preemptive with getting him right now because there's going to be a massive rush and there are going to be people that will blow their fab money completely just to get a shot at this guy. And when you look at what he's doing in the minors, you know, 282, 8 homers, 25 RBI, 14 steals, you know, only 22 years old, you know, not an old 22, but this guy's going to come up sooner or later. The Phillies are starting to look at, you know, emptying their prospects. You know, Nick Williams is a guy that they feel is on the cusp of being recalled. He's not a guy I would really look at in regular standard leagues, but in deeper league formats or NL-only leagues, he's probably somebody you want to probably take a look at as well. J.P. Crawford is probably coming up at some point in the future. Despite the fact he's in 194, he's probably going to get a late-season look at some point. You know, as bad as the Phillies are, they really aren't going to hurt themselves by bringing Crawford up in September, or if not before then, giving him an opportunity to get a chance to see what they really have out of him. Austin Meadows has struggled a bit. I don't think that he's going to come up, although there has been some traction with him. William Daines, you know, we mentioned, you know, he is starting to get some traction as well. When you look at, you know, the rumors about him coming up, you know, that's actually brought up his ownership significantly over the last couple of weeks. If you had asked me this question a couple of weeks ago, I would have said that Lucas Giolito was a ball player that would have ended up being a strong pickup, and that people were paying attention to him. But now, you know, the control problems are still persistent. 4.95 ERA. You know, I am of the opinion that at some point that I don't think they're going to see him this season. A couple of other guys that, you know, you look at Alex Verdugo of the Dodgers has started to get some traction as well. You know, 340 average, 3 home runs, 34 RBI up in AAA Oklahoma City. And when you look at the fact that, you know, the Dodgers, you know, they're getting good numbers out of Bellinger, Seager's having an all-star caliber year, but that outfield really isn't doing much of anything right now. And I think that at some point in time, you're going to see Verdugo. I think you're probably going to see Verdugo after the all-star break. So I would venture going in and making sure that if you've got an open roster spot and your league allows you to keep a minor league player on that roster, I'd go ahead and be proactive and go ahead and grab him at this point. When I look at pitcher, there are a couple of arms that you know you might want to consider taking a look at this point. One arm you might want to take a look at with the way the Padres are, you know, very, you know, up down as far as moving prospects are concerned. You know, Cal Quantrill is probably more of a deeper end guy. Their first round pick in 2016. I wouldn't be shocked if he gets a look at some point late in the season. The Astros are probably looking to move up some of their arms. You know, we've already seen that Francis Martez is up. David Paulino is already up right now. I would think that Paulino's probably going to go down once Lance McCullers comes up the disabled list on Saturday. But there is a pretty good chance you're going to see at least one more arm coming up in the very near future. So I would take a look at, you know, the Astros minor league system. Yadiel Gustave was doing well, but you know, the Tommy John surgery has knocked them out. He's probably not going to be a factor until 2019, and this is a guy who's 24 years old, so by the time he gets back, his prospect stage is pretty much gone at this point. But as a whole, I think that when you look at, you know, the minor league guys, I think that you're probably not going to get that big of a rush on the minor league prospects this week. I think that it's kind of a calm before the season. You're going to see two runs on prospects in July. I think you're going to see that post-all-star break run, and you're going to see the trade deadline run on prospects. So right now I think it's going to be pretty quiet as far as prospects are concerned, as far as the waiver wire.
We're talking the waiver wire with Brandon C. Williams from rotoexperts.com. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at BCWilliams71. If you want to follow me, Chris Mitchell, your host here of a podcast to be named later, you can follow me on Twitter at CJMitch73. I write for rotoexperts.com as well as minorleagueball.com, which is where these podcasts are actually posted. Brandon, I like to talk about the hot additions and the cold subtractions over at ESPN on a weekly basis. This is a segment I think is valuable because evaluating what the rest of your league is doing is probably as important, if not more important, than the actual players you're claiming, adding, or dropping, because sometimes players get dropped who shouldn't, and sometimes a whole bunch of players are claimed that really probably aren't worth it, or you spend a lot of money on a player that isn't really worth it, or just the opposite. You see a lot of people start to claim somebody, say, wow, I better get on this, or I'm going to miss the train here. I looked at a lot of the drops, and I wasn't all that surprised. Matt Harvey being dropped after the injury, and he's probably droppable before he was hurt, and now that he is hurt, I don't have any problem whatsoever with dropping him, and he was dropped by everybody. He went from he's basically as cold as you can get. Neil Walker dropped. Ben Zobrist was dropped in a lot of leagues. Rich Hill was a little bit, but again, I don't care about that much. It's not that big of a deal. I don't believe that Hill is really startable. I own him in a league, and I haven't started him yet, and I have no plans to because I don't think he can go six or seven innings. So even in double start weeks, I'm not starting Rich Hill. So on the most dropped list, I didn't really see a name that I said, you know what, we really need to consider this and analyze it. However, on the most added list, I saw some very intriguing names, and I got to say, people got to be reading my articles over rotoexperts.com. They don't appear every single day or even every single week necessarily sometimes. But the guys at the top right now are guys that I have been talking about, at least a couple of them. Jacob Faria, I wrote about him a month ago that he was a guy that could be promoted. And with the kind of strikeout totals he was doing in the minor league this season, but also for his career, this was a guy you had to be on board with. As of last week, he was owned in 17% of ESPN leagues. Now, finally, when everybody is on board with this guy, now, finally, everybody claims him. 43.9% of people claimed him this week on ESPN. His ownership's up to 61%. Like I said, I told you about this guy a month ago. Why did it take you a month to take my advice? Then you've got Trey Mancini. He's number two. I actually started him this week on one of my dynasty leagues. We only start three outfielders, and yet he's one of my three outfielders, and I'm one of the best teams in the league. Trey Mancini was owned in 16.7% of leagues. Now all of a sudden, 33% more people decided that he was finally worth their time, and he's owned now in 49.7% of leagues, still under 50, which I think is the number that you like to use to determine whether a guy is a true waiver wire possibility or if he's owned by so many people that he no longer is considered a waiver wire guy. So Mancini would still be, by most people's considerations, a waiver wire possibility, and he's still owned by less than 50%. I can't believe that some of these guys on this, Matt Adams was owned in 17.5%. Have you been paying attention at how he's been hitting since he became a Brave? They're actually looking to move Freddie Freeman from first base to third base because they don't want Adams out of the lineup. I mean, Freddie Freeman playing third base. He cannot play third base. But yet Matt Adams is hitting so well that they cannot put him on the bench. Matt Adams has tried outfield, and he was a complete and utter disaster. He was Schwarber bad out there in left field. So Matt Adams has to play first base. And he's hitting so well that Freddie Freeman is actually going to have to move positions when he returns. That's how good he's been. Let me ask you about these guys. Let's start with Jacob Faria. Let's go with Trey Mancini. Let's look at Mike Zunino, Matt Adams. Let's start with Faria. As a prospect, a rookie who may end up having his innings limited, is he a must-own guy, and where in the pecking order? Is he a top-five starter where on a one-start week you would be using him, or is he a matchup situation or a two-start guy? Give me your thoughts on Jacob Faria.
I look at this top six, and of the six, five of these are guys that I had written about, over the past 3 weeks. If you go back and you look at my waiver wire column last week on rotoexperts.com, I profiled Faria, I profiled Mancini, I profiled Zunino. Matt Adams is a guy that I profiled immediately after the injury to Freeman. Andrelton Simmons is a guy that I profiled a couple of weeks ago along with Cameron Maven. So, yeah, I think we're both ahead of the curve on this. When you look at Faria, he's had three strong starts. He's won his first three games. He's only allowed three runs in his first three starts. You look at the fact that this guy has 22 strikeouts and only four walks and 19 in the two-thirds innings. It does not seem as if this guy is just some passing fat. I think that he's got some very strong fantasy potential, not just for now, but also for the end of the season. I think that obviously he's not going to stand a 1.37 ERA and a 0.97 WHIP. Obviously, there's going to be some regression that comes along with that, but I think that he's here to stay. I think that he is an elite guy when it comes to waiver wire at this point. If he is still available, I would certainly be scrambling on him right now. When you look at Mancini, he's got first base eligibility now with Chris Davis on the disabled list. 314, 12 homers, 38 RBI. I suggested when I did the first of two profiles on Mancini this season on my waiver wire column that Mancini was a guy who I thought that given enough at-bats could hit around 275, 280 with 20-plus home runs over the course of the season. He looks like he's on pace to exceed that, and the batting average is certainly something I am quite surprised about. Now, the guy number three, Mike Fiers of the Houston Astros, has really come on over the last few weeks. Over the last four starts, he's only allowed four earned runs. He had a nice solid outing the other day against Oakland. Six innings, three hits, one earned run, struck out five. He's not a big strikeout guy, although he's had eight strikeouts in two games over his last six starts. But when you look at his last six starts, they have been solid. The fact that he's only allowed three earned runs just once. Right now, he is moving up ownership ranks at 41% in ESPN leagues, and I think that those numbers are going to be better. And Dallas Keuchel back full time. I think that he's been a very pleasant surprise in that Astros rotation. Mike Zunino has had a mammoth June. This was a guy that on May 31st was hitting 194. And now he's at 252 9 homers, 30 RBI, and he had a 2-home-run game on Sunday, you know, and drove in 4 on that. You know, this guy has really been swinging it since he had, like, a brief stint in AAA. It was kind of a, you know, we need to shake you up a little bit kind of thing with them few games, but then he pops back up. But now, you know, he is certainly a guy that, you know, has a ton of value, and at 34% is continuing to climb. And in the wake of Oakland making an announcement a few minutes ago about the fact that they are putting Voit on assignment, you know, if you own Voit, you know, you need a catcher at this point. And if Zunino's out there, you certainly want to grab him. Like you mentioned, Matt Adams has just been sizzling. He played 293, 12 home runs, 36 RBI. We knew the big guy can hit, but I didn't suspect that he would hit so much to the point that Freddie Freeman wants to play third base once he comes back. But Adams, you know, one thing that you might want to keep in mind is that, you know, this is a Braves team that is still in rebuild phase. And while, you know, there are, you know, reasons to think that, you know, if Freeman comes back and fields the ball fairly well at third base, you know, you've got two power bats on a team that could certainly use another pop, could use some more pop in that lineup. But Adams would certainly look pretty darn good for AL team that could use a DH. So that's something that you might want to keep in mind.
Yeah, let me ask you about a few other names real quickly here. First, let me ask you about Chris Taylor. You mentioned Alex Verdugo as a guy that you really like. I don't know where the Dodgers find places for all these people. Adrian Gonzalez is going to play again this season purely because he's owed so much money. I mean, it could come to a point, I guess, where the Dodgers have to make a really difficult decision if Agon really continues to really be as bad as he's been. So I guess, in theory, the Dodgers could bite the bullet and say, look, we love Adrian Gonzalez. He's a good guy. He's a good organization guy. He's not a troublemaker like a Puig. But he's just terrible, and we have to sit him. That could happen, but you don't usually see it, especially a guy with an enormous contract. So I would think the Dodgers are still going to give Adrian Gonzalez opportunities when he comes back, and even if he plays poorly, he's still going to play at least some of the time, which means Cody Bellinger, who is on pace for like 55 home runs or something, if not for Aaron Judge, Cody Bellinger would be the story of Major League Baseball this season. So if Alex Verdugo is going to be of any value, I don't know where they find – I don't know where Chris Taylor continues to find his at-bats, and yet he's been fantastic, and he's owned in almost 60% of leagues. So I guess let me ask you that Dodger situation. I guess Cody Bellinger could do what Jock Peterson did last year, where he went from being the darling of the first half to pretty much a disaster in the second half. That could happen to any rookie. So Cody Bellinger – who sort of looks a lot like Jock Peterson. It almost seems like he's almost the twin of what Peterson was in his rookie season. But how do you find at bats for Chris Taylor and Bellinger and Adrian Gonzalez? And then if you like Verdugo or any of the other minor league guys, where do these at bats come from? Because Chris Taylor's been really good. And it seems like they were talking about him on the broadcast last night. I was watching a little bit of the game when he was on, and they were saying how he's, the announcer said one of the dumbest comments that I just can't stand. This guy is going to continue to play as long as he continues to hit. Well, obviously that's the case. I remember when Ian Happ was the hot name in Chicago, and my thought was that thought, which is I don't believe that Ian Happ is a must-own fantasy guy because I don't think there are at-bats for him unless he continues to rake. So if a guy continues to hit, of course he's going to continue to play. That it doesn't take an expert or a genius to know that. And so to say that is almost stupid. You know, as long as he continues to hit, he's going to hit, of course. But he's probably not going to continue to hit. Whereas if a guy has been so good, sometimes he's going to continue to play even if he doesn't hit. That, to me, is what you need to be looking at. Is Chris Taylor playing well enough now where if he struggles, the Dodgers aren't going to give up on him and find it bad for somebody else? Is that Chris Taylor, or does he have to hit to stay? Because that's my opinion, is that Chris Taylor has to hit to stay, and I just don't think he's going to continue to hit, which means I wouldn't be necessarily claiming him. He's going to go cold and eventually lose a bat.
He could play him at second. He could play him at third. I'm pretty sure that if Seager needed a day off, you could probably plug him at short, and you wouldn't get much of a drop-off. You can also play him in the outfield as well. I think the fact is that, you know, he does hit for pop. He does seem as if, you know, he does seem like he's on a pace, 9 home runs, 8 steals. He's on pace to go, you know, 18 home runs, maybe, you know, 18, 19 stolen bases. You know, it's not out of the realm of possibility. It's got to go 15, 20 when it comes to home runs and stolen bases. But, again, you're right. You know, the Dodgers are going to eventually find themselves in a bit of a logjam, especially if, you know, the rumors are true and Verdugo does come up at some point in time. But again, you know, you have to point out the fact that, you know, Taylor has been hitting insanely well. You're starting to see signs of cool off. Anyway, you know, he has been in a stretch. You know, he's been hitless in his last two games, 0-for-8. You know, and he's kind of scuffled, you know, in his last five. He's only had one multi-hit game where he was on a stretch where it seemed like every other day he was getting multiple hits. But the one thing you have to look at is Taylor's versatility. And I think that's the one thing that's going to work for him. You will be able to find ways to get him in the lineup, you know, obviously because he's hitting. But the fact is that, you know, he's a good fill-in if you want to get one of your starters a day off, or if someone's in a slump, or if someone ends up going on the DL. It's one of those things to where Taylor does a lot, and that versatility is really going to keep him in the lineup as well. And you also have to wonder, you know, not only about, you know, Adrian Gonzalez and his future, and it doesn't really look good at this point. I think that there is some prospect of him maybe moving on, you know, perhaps being, you know, retiring early or at least or doing something to where, you know, the bottom line is that isn't the guy that he once was. And two, that injury is really, you know, more serious than I think people are really, you know, believing it is. But if that happens, you've got that, and you also have the prospects of maybe the Dodgers being preemptive and deciding, you know, we've had enough of Yasiel Puig. Maybe we'll move him at the deadline. You know, maybe wouldn't be really shocked if the Dodgers outright released him if they just felt that there really wasn't anything more that they could do with him. If any one of those scenarios does come into play, that means that Taylor's going to be first in line for more playing time as well. So I think that when you look at Chris Taylor, here's a guy who I think his versatility is a strong suit, and that versatility is going to keep him in the lineup most days.
Yeah, that is a good point. I think that's the only justification for liking Taylor. That is definitely, even if he doesn't keep hitting at this level, as long as he's not batting 120, you look at it and say, yeah, you know what? The Dodgers aren't that great at second base. Yeah, Corey Seager could need a day off on occasion. Justin Turner tweaked an injury again just recently. So Turner's been having a hard time staying on the field at third base. So maybe you need to – maybe he gets another DL stint, or maybe Turner just needs some day off from time to time so that you can get him out there three times a week rather than have to place him on the DL or have him constantly being injured. And he can probably move into the outfield where Jock Peterson – I don't think Jock Peterson hits lefties all that well. Peterson and Bellinger are three outcome guys. They either hit a home run, they strike out, or they walk. So if you want to take them out, especially against a tough lefty, though I don't think Bellinger's having really a problem against anybody recently, but – nonetheless, Peterson and Bellinger against a tough lefty, since they strike out so much, that I agree with you. The versatility that Taylor provides is very – I think that's right on point. That's a good that's not something I really considered when I posed you the question, but now that you say it, that's very much a good point there. We talked about Trey Mancini, and I mentioned Jacob Faria over a month ago as far as you had to be on this rookie. I was on Trey Mancini before the season. I wrote him up as one of my top 25 rookie prospects as far as having a good rookie season this year. And one of the caveats that I put in that article, in that that profile for the draft kit, was not only does Mancini have kind of impact offensive potential as far as mostly home runs, but his batting average, as you said, has been even better than expected. He's not really a batting average guy, but he's just a good hitter. So the batting average is probably at the very least going to be respectable. But my only question with Mancini, I would have had him as one of the five best rookies for fantasy coming into this season if I knew that he was going to get full-time playing time. So essentially, my opinion was Trey Mancini is a must-own prospect if he's a full-time player. And if he also qualifies in the outfield, then he's absolutely one of your five best outfielders in a league, unless it's really shallow. So I was pretty high on Mancini coming into the season, and he is getting full-time at bat. So by my analysis coming into the season, you have to own Trey Mancini. And finally, almost 50% of the people are coming around on that. The other name that I find interesting that was just recently promoted, who is not being added yet, is Matt Chapman of the Oakland A's. I talked about him in the preseason. I think I ranked him in my top 25, or he might have been an honorable mention, because I had some honorable mentions where I didn't write them up really, but I gave you a quick little snapshot of what I thought of them. And Matt Chapman was not going to get at bats. They already had a third baseman in Oakland. They're not going to promote a rookie because they're not going to win, so they're going to wait until Super 2 passed. But the one thing I really liked about Matt Chapman is he has the power to be an impact guy, and he has the defense to stay on the field. So if the A's do want to get this guy experience, he can contribute from a fantasy perspective with his power, and the A's can feel justified in keeping him on the field full-time, even if he struggles, because they want to get him that experience, and he's a plus defender at third base. To me, those are the ways that rookies stay on the field, even if they're not hitting well enough to do it. Ian Happ probably fits that mold too, but because the Cubs have so many versatile players, it really doesn't. You mentioned it with Chris Taylor, his versatility on a team that really needs versatility, because Chase Utley can't play even part-time, never mind full-time, at second base. So his versatility absolutely makes him a viable rookie, even when he struggles. What are your thoughts on Matt Chapman? Is this a guy that you got to go out and own because of the power potential, or what are your thoughts on Matt Chapman?
He's a guy that I profiled last week. I like him, but I also added the caveat that whereas the power potential is great, and if he does get regular at-bats, he's probably somebody who could probably hit 15 home runs this season. But the thing is that the strikeouts are just frightening. You know, 63 strikeouts and 175 at-bats in the minors, and it's carried over to the bigs. 7 strikeouts in his first 14 at-bats. It's not to say you give up on this guy completely just on 14 at-bats, but, you know, you're going to have to live with some very bad moments before you get with the good. This guy certainly has 30 home run potential, and I think that the A's obviously are at a point to where they can afford to give Chapman at-bats on a daily basis. They're not, you know, going anywhere at this point, so you might as well find out what this guy has, and I think that, you know, he's one of those guys that will stay in the lineup again, like you mentioned, you know, unless this guy's hitting 185 and not giving you any power. You know, that's really, to me, the only way he doesn't go out of the lineup. I like him if you can afford the fact that he's going to struggle and he's going to hurt your batting average a bit. But, again, you know, when you look at the power, and you know, at this point in the season, finding good power in the waiver wires can be a bit of a challenge. So I look at him as a guy that I would probably take – I would roll the dice on. Again, like I said – the strikeouts are going to be a bit of an issue, but he's also that kind of guy who can hit 4 or 5 home runs in 1 week. So, you know, when you're trying to balance it out, he is indeed, like, you know, you mentioned with the 2 Dodgers players, he's a 3 true outcome kind of guy. But I think that he's a guy that if you need power, I think that he's worth the risk.
And he was just placed on the disabled list, but it wasn't with a serious injury. He was placed on the 10-day DL with an infection. And in this day and age where you can put guys on the short-term DL, that's really killing fantasy. So many guys are being put on the DL. And it doesn't kill you for the season, because if a guy's going to miss 2 or 3 days, the team just says, I don't care. If he's going to miss 2 or 3 already, let's just give him 10. That really hurts us, because these guys – sometimes you'd start a guy if he's going to be there for at least half a week. Well, now with this new 10-day DL, if he's going to be out half a week anyway – just give him. They just essentially say, let's give him the whole week, and they put him on the 10-day DL. In this case, Matt Chapman was just placed on the 10 DL with an infection. He's been given antibiotics. In a few days, it'll be gone, and he'll be ready to play again, but he's on the DL anyway, so he'll be out 10 days. So don't look and say we're talking about his potential value, and he was just disabled. He was disabled for a nuisance, not a real injury that will impact his potential to play when he returns. So just to keep you in mind, anyone who ends up looking on the waiver wire and see that he's on the DL and is thinking, why the hell were we recommending him or talking about him at all? It's not a serious DL stint. He has an infection. We're talking with Brandon C. Williams from RotoExperts.com. Brandon, let's get to the meat of it and get you out of here. Let's get to the actual waiver wire report. First, the bats at the top of the wire. Who are the bats you like that you need to be claiming right now? We covered a couple of them, obviously, with the ad drops, but give me some of the other guys you like this week.
Some of the guys that, you know, I do like this week when you look offensively. You know, the aforementioned Zanino and Mancini continue to pick up a ton of momentum in CBS Sports Leagues. Again, you know, these are guys you need to be grabbing on. If they're still in your league at this point, you probably need to go ahead and grab them and put a roster spot on them. One guy that we'll be talking about this week, Matt Davidson, the DH for the Chicago White Sox. His ownership is now shot up to 28%. He has really been hitting the daylights out of the ball. And remember, a few years ago, Davidson was a prospect that, you know, a lot of people were starting to give up on because he didn't think that the power was ever going to come. Guess what? It's popped up again. Huge constant strikeouts, 82 whiffs and 192 at bats, but he's got 16 home runs, 37 RBI, and he has been ripping it up late, 4 home runs in his last 7 games. He's at 18%, actually at 26% right now in CBS Sports Leagues. It's an up, it's a change from 15% from last week. He's certainly a guy that you might want to go ahead and grab on. Again, if you need some pop, he is probably a ball player you want to take a strong look at. Eduardo Escobar, the Minnesota Twins, is starting to pick up a little bit. It's not earth-shattering, but in deeper leagues, Escobar is probably somebody you might want to take a look at. You know, the power is a bit of a surprise right now. 7 home runs, 25 RBI in 46 games. He hit 12 in 127 games last year, but he's hitting 300 right now. And he's put together a nice string of multi-hit games. He's got 4 out of his last 7, including a 3-hit game last week against the Mariners. Again, he's at 12% right now. He shot up from 3% last week. So in deeper league formats, he's probably a guy you want to take a good look at. Another guy to look at offensively, Ben Gamel of the Seattle Mariners. He continues to start, you know, he's continuing to hit the ball. 353, 3 home runs, 22 RBI in 51 games. He's got 2 stolen bases. You know, it was just a case of where, you know, he was, you know, getting spot starts here and there, but now that bat is so hot that the Mariners have just put him in the order. You know, he comes into Thursday with a 13-game hit streak. And right now, with the way he's hitting, you know, if you need a boost in that bat, you know, in your batting average, you certainly want to take a look at this guy again. You know, in deeper league formats, he is probably someone that's got more value there than he would in standards, but with the way he's hitting, that's probably not going to change. That's probably going to change at some point in the very near future. David Peralta of the Diamondbacks, he's just over my threshold at 51%, but still, he's someone that you might want to take a look at. He has been hitting the ball well, and you know, we talked about it last week with the fact of just how well the Diamondbacks as a whole are just hitting the ball this season. This is a team that's geared on offense, and Peralta has really benefited off of that this season. So he's someone that you want to take a good look at. Carlos Perez is starting to get a little bit of traction. He's sold at 48% of leagues. I know that a couple of weeks back I said you give up on him. I still think that's the case. However, if you do want to try to buy into the fact that maybe, you know, as the weather gets hot in Texas, he gets hot, it's a high-risk move. But Gonzalez does offer some upside there. Ronnie Chisenhall out in Cleveland as a batter. That's, you know, getting pretty solid production right now. Again, he's probably someone that's more valuable in deeper leagues at this point, but again, he's one of those guys to where you might want to start putting a watch on him when it comes to the more standard leagues. One other guy to take a look at when it comes to deeper leagues, Jose Pirella of the Padres is a guy that I profiled last week, and I mentioned that, you know, you want to go ahead and grab the guy and catch on to the hot streak before it fades out, but you know, he continues the hot streak. You know, he stole 2 bases Wednesday. He's got 3 on the season, so basically he doubled his stolen base output. He's got 3 home runs, 9 RBI, 350 batting average, and 57 at bats. He does have, you know, he's a second baseman by trade, but it shouldn't take long, if not by now, for him to have outfield eligibility. So he's someone that I'm currently playing in my NL-only league. But I think that in deeper leagues and, you know, and deeper leagues, I should say, he's probably someone you want to take a very strong look at. If he continues to hit and he does continue to add the stolen base element to his game, it's not going to be long before he starts becoming a little more viable in standard leagues. I think that you have someone that's on the disabled list. A good example is that you've got a Matt Chapman on the disabled list and you're just trying to fill the spot for a week or so. Perella is a guy that you can run with, you know, ride the hot streak, and, you know, if it does look like he's cooling off around the same time Chapman gets off the disabled list, you know, it's a good move. It's a thanks, but thanks for playing, but you did the job kind of move.
All right, let's move over to the talking about the pitchers here. We covered a lot of bats there. Give me some of the pitchers at the top of the wire that you like.
Jason Hamill of the Royals is a guy that has really put it on of late. He's now at 44% ownership at this point in the season. He doesn't strike you as a guy that, you know, has a lot of fantasy value. Has never really been a guy that, you know, you really look at as a strong fantasy player, but right now, he has worked that ERA down from a point where it was one, you know, in the upper six, you know, the mid upper six. He got down to 4.82, and that's because of the strong outfit. He's got wins in three of his last four starts. He's not a good strikeout guy, but one thing that he's done in that four-game stretch is that he's only allowed one walk. He is a, you know, if you look at his numbers just strictly on the season, you might just ignore him, but if you take a closer look at what he's done lately, that's probably where he comes in and provides you value. Francis Martez of the Astros, touched on him briefly, but he is in the rotation for the time being. Came close to getting a quality start in his last start on Tuesday night, but still, you know, 5 2/3 innings, he did get the win, struck out four. He's got wins in his last two starts, and it will be interesting to see what the Astros do with him in the very near future. You know, it does look like McCullers is going to be back this weekend. Looks like he is probably going to get the start on Friday, actually, against the Mariners. And it's a possibility, you know, either Friday or Saturday, it's, he could probably get that start. But Dallas Keuchel's probably about another week and a half off the disabled, coming off the disabled list as well. So at some point in time, Martez is probably going to go down. I say probably, but again, it's probably someone you want to hold on to if you can stash him off, because he'll certainly come up at the next time and, someone goes on the DL, or certainly come simply use him as a bullpen arm. A couple of other pitchers to take a look at, John Doolittle, the Doolittle in Oakland, recently off the disabled list. He's now at 22% ownership. He's got three saves right now. So it looks like, you know, he's back to where he is, where he was before coming off the DL. 2.31 ERA, a .60 WHIP. He's got 18 strikeouts and 11 2/3 innings. So the bearded one is looking like his old self again. He's certainly a guy you want to grab onto. 22% ownership right now in CBS Sports Leagues. If you're looking for saves, you know, you certainly need to go ahead and grab him right now. Seth Lugo of the Mets is a guy that I touched on last week. You know, look, in the wake of all the injuries that the pitching staff has had, I stress that Lugo is going to be a big factor in how the Mets, you know, can make a bid for a wild card spot. Hasn't disappointed me. He had a tough loss in his last outing. He gave up 7 hits, struck out 5. But again, when you look at the fact that, you know, he's got a 2.63 ERA, a 1.24 WHIP, he's a guy, you know, he's going to be good, but not great. But, you know, you're not going to get a staff of Clayton Kershaw's and Chris Sale's. He's at 47% right now. He's a guy I recommend very strongly. I think that he will be a solid add for the remainder of the season. Nick Pivetta, one of the many young arms that the Phillies have called up, and he certainly won't be the last before the season ends, struck out 10 on Wednesday night. Got the no decision against the Cardinals, but yo, he is flashing that strikeout ability. He has 46 strikeouts in 42 innings, and you look at his last two starts, 19 whiffs in 13 innings. And for a Phillies team that needs that kind of strikeout arm, he is a welcome presence. He's only off in 12% of leagues right now, but if he continues with that strikeout rate, that number is going to double pretty soon. I think in deeper leagues, he's someone that you want to grab a hold of right now. I think even in standard leagues, if you need a jolt in strikeouts, he's someone that you want to take a look at. Jose Urena of the Marlins is a guy that I like. I'm normally not a big fan of the non-strikeout guys, but yeah, Urena's kind of stuck on me this season. He's been solid. He's strung together some quality starts. Most recent one was his last one on Saturday. And you look at his numbers for the season, he's 5-2, 3.63 ERA. He's got a 1.24 whiff. Again, doesn't strike out a lot of people, 41 and 64 innings, but he's dependable. And that's the thing that you'll have to like about him. The thing that you also have to look at as well is the fact that his last three outings, he's only allowed three hits in each of them. So when you look at the fact that 15 innings, he's only allowed 9 hits, and at the same time, 6 walks, that's a whip of 1. And, you can live with that. Again, not a great guy when you look at his peripherals, all in 20% of leagues, but, in a deeper league format, you could do a heck of a lot worse than what you're getting out of Jose Urena out in out in Miami. A couple other guys to take a look at out in Seattle. Sam, I don't want to butcher the guy's name, but Gaviglio. Excuse me, that's the name. That's his name. But he's been a quiet yet effective pitcher this season. 3-1. 3.43 ERA and a whip of 1.19. He struck out 25 in 39 innings, but it seems like every time the Mariners give him the ball, he gives them a solid 5 innings. He's not going to go deep in the ball games, but he's been solid for the most part. And I think that if you're in an AL-only league or in a deeper league format, Gaviglio is a guy that you might want to take a very good look at because he's going to remain in the rotation even once Felix Hernandez comes off the DL. It looks like King Felix is going to make his return on Friday against the Astros. One other guy before we take it home, Archie Bradley of the Diamondbacks. Remember, once upon a time, this guy was one of the top 3 or 4 minor league arms out there. Didn't fare well as a starter. The Diamondbacks, brought him up to start of the season. He made the roster, I should say. In middle relief, and you kind of went with the notion that, maybe he gets a look as a starter, but I think they found something with him as a middle reliever. You look at his numbers right now, they have been very solid this season. He's been very impressive when you take a look at Bradley. He's got 3 wins on the season. He's got ERA at 1.10, a .85 whiff. And the thing that you liked about Bradley coming up was the fact that he was a strikeout artist, and just didn't have strikeout ability show itself up. 41 strikeouts in 32 2/3 innings. I think that not only do you look at Bradley as a heck of a guy, 27% ownership, I think you look at it as a nice middle relief guy, one of those few middle relievers that you can have that have value in fantasy leagues. But to me, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that at some point in the season, the Diamondbacks consider looking at this guy as a closer. And that possibility does happen. His ownership is lights out.
Talking with Brant C. Williams from RotoExperts.com. You can follow him on Twitter at BCWilliams71. Brandon, I talked about how some of the more popular drops are out there, and Matt Harvey is one of them. And I like to ask you every single week, who is a big established name that you'd say, wow, you're actually saying that I can drop this guy in yearly league? Dynasty league, you never drop a star. No matter how bad he is, you just bench him and you hold him, and that's the way you have to roll. But in yearly leagues, we are almost in July now, and there are some veterans that you could say, you know what, this guy's just going to stop. He's just not going to get it done. It's not a difficult decision to cut Matt Harvey. He not only has been awful, but he's now injured and may not be back for maybe at all. So I don't give anybody credit for biting the bullet and cutting Matt Harvey. Who are some established, they've been stars in the past or at least very good players. Who are some big fantasy names that would be a little bit of a surprise to see on the wire, but you think justify being released?
I think that at some point in time, you're probably going to be honest with yourself and start thinking that Adam Wainwright is never going to be the guy that you expect he once was. He got shelled in his last start against the Orioles. He's now 7-5, an ERA of 5.75 at this point, a WHIP of 1.63. At this point in time, you're probably safe to go ahead and cut him off and move forward elsewhere. Obviously, you know, you can't say, you know, Neil Walker, the guy's injured. So, you know, you could talk about maybe cutting him, but you better have a good second option at second base. We mentioned Ben Zobras, a guy you can get rid of. Evan Gattis, I think, you know, it might be time to start thinking about moving on from him. You know, he's playing sparingly at this point. He's hitting .267, 4 home runs, 26 RBI. But he has been, you know, again, like I mentioned, he's been very sparingly in the lineup. And I think that, you know, if you're looking for someone who's going to give you a little more production, is going to play more each day than Gattis is. Gattis obviously has the DH eligibility. In some leagues, he's going to have catcher eligibility as well. But with the presence of Brian McCann, Evan Gattis's value has been hurt significantly. I think he could probably be wise to go ahead and move on him, even though there is always the risk of what happens if McCann does go on the disabled list for an extended period. Another guy I think you could probably take a look at and say, you know, move on. Victor Martinez at this point. You know, his ownership is now at 41%. You know, he's hitting .261, 5 home runs, 29 RBI. He could be back off the disabled list in the near future. But right now, you know, the Victor Martinez that he got last year with the .289, 27 home runs, 86 RBI, I think that guy, you know, was pretty much, you know, might be the farewell. That might have been the farewell outstanding season. You know, when I looked at Martinez, you know, going into this year, my whole notion was that, you know, you get rid of a guy a year early than a year too late. And I think that owners that drafted Martinez thinking you're going to get more production out of him are learning out the hard way that, you know, you probably might have been better off staying away from him. Domingo Santana is actually starting to lose a little bit of traction as far as ownership. A little bit surprising, though. Santana guy, and he has had a fairly strong season, but right now it just seems like, you know, he's been a bit of a cold stretch because he's one of those guys that, you know, when he's good, but he does go through stretches where he goes through tons of strikeouts, but it does look like he's been one of those. His ownership's dipped down from 74% to 69%, and unless he turns things around in the near future, it's probably going to go that way. It's probably going to continue going south. Kevin Kiermaier of the Rays, injuries have slowed him down. That's the reason why his ownership has fallen off. He was having a pretty strong start and was really, you know, a guy that, you know, looked at one moment in time in the season, looked like he'd be a fantasy surprise, but he's cooled off significantly. He's probably still probably best off shaking away from. I'm torn on Hanley Ramirez. You know, and you're a Red Sox guy, and I know that, you know, he's owned in 89% of leagues, but the shoulder soreness, you know, it's got to be an issue. He's only hitting .239. He's got 9 home runs, but that .239 batting average is a far cry from what we got out of him last season. You know, I think that at this point, I think you're better off just keeping him on your bench until otherwise. But, you know, it is a bit of a concern. A couple of other guys, you know, that you look at and decide, you know, it's time to move on from them. You know, guys that, you know, you normally wouldn't stay from. I look at, you know, people still believe that Neftali Feliz is going to come back and get the closer's job in Milwaukee. You know, but the fact of the matter is, it's Corey Neville's job. You know, Feliz is probably someone who I wouldn't be surprised gets an outright release at some point in the season. Yasmani Tomas, you know, we talked about him last week. His ownership continues to go down a bit. He's now at 70% at this point. He could be off the disabled list by the end of the month, maybe the first part of July. But right now, you know, .241, 8 homers, 32 RBI, you know, he really wasn't doing anything that suggested that big season that he had last year was going to lead to a strong follow-up. Brad Miller, is on in 37% of leagues. I know he's on the DL, but again, it's frustrating. You know, with the constant groin strains. You know, he's in. He was only hitting 194 before he went down anyway. So, you know, letting him go really isn't going to shake things as far as what you lose out of him. Albert Pujols is starting to lose a bit now. He's at 88% ownership. He's what he is at this point. You know, he hits home runs. He's not going to give you much as far as batting average. And on-base percentage is starting to fall off significantly as well. I wouldn't recommend it in deeper leagues. You know, I think that there is some value there. But, you know, in a more standard league, it's probably best that you move on from Pujols. Again, he's a one-dimensional ball player at this point. You look at Joey Gallo, another guy who's starting to lose some ownership as well because, you know, you can only deal so much with the strikeouts. But with Pujols, the strikeouts are continuing to climb up. He's on pace for about 140 strikeouts this season. So you're probably best moving off from Pujols if you've got a roster spot that you know you can pick up and get better production from.
He's Brandon C. Williams. He writes over at rotoexperts.com. You can follow him on Twitter to find out all of his content in all of the different places he does it, at BCWilliams71, talking Waiver Wire Report with us today. Thanks a lot, Brandon. We went long, we went deep, we went in-depth, as always, with you. Thanks for coming on today. Hopefully we'll talk some baseball in the next few days or so, but enjoy that Texas heat. And again, thanks for the Waiver Wire Report and all of your discussions today, man.
Yeah, always a problem. Always no problem with you, Chris. Always enjoy a busy day for me. Start of Canadian Football League season. So I'll be active on Twitter tonight talking CFL football. It's Saskatchewan taking on Montreal. That game is actually available for us Yanks on ESPN News. Also, we've got the NBA draft going on as well, the prospect of a potential blockbuster or two. Can't promise when that article will come out, but it'll be sometime this weekend. We'll take a look at the draft, and we'll take a look at the fantasy impact that each of the first round, some of the key first rounders will offer as well. So pretty busy time for me, but it's enjoyable, and it's always great to talk to you, Chris, so we'll do it again soon.
You just made a mistake. I got to ask you another question since you mentioned that. I am not a basketball guy. I love March Madness. I hate the NBA. You know this. But my Celtics had the number one pick. My Celtics had the number one pick. And the thought of it before the trade rumors happened and before the actual trade happened was that Foles was by far and away the best number one pick. It was no question that he was the number one. But there wasn't a lot of down talk about him. They didn't say that he was the next LeBron James. Nobody claimed that Foles could be that guy. But there was clear separation between him and everyone else. That was the thought, at least up here. Then all of a sudden the rumors start happening, and then all of a sudden the trade starts happening, and of course people are trying to justify it up here. And they're saying that while Foles is good, he's relatively a bad overall best pick compared to some other years. He's not the potential star that every draft seems to have at least one or two of them. He's a low-end guy compared to previous years. And that's what some people up here were using to justify trading away the one and dropping down to three. Tell me how good Foles is, how good he can be, and are the Celtics smart to go down to three, and are they smart to move back to five or eight or whatever the heck they're going to be? Give me an idea of what I should be thinking when the Boston people are trying to spin all this craziness. Is Foles a potential transcendent player or what?
I think the potential is there for him to be a transcendent player, and I think that 3 or 4 years from now, you could probably be looking at, you know, this move as the move that began to shift the balance of power in the East to the Philadelphia 76ers. I think that if you have a healthy Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons, and also Markelle Fultz to go along with Dario Saric and Robert Covington and a fairly, you know, decent cast of role players, I think that the Philadelphia 76ers will make the playoffs this season. I think that they could be a team that could be a force to be reckoned with if these guys can stay healthy and live up to their potential. Fultz is still clearly to me the best player in the draft. I think that with Boston, I think the thing that, you know, that showed me is that they're committed to finding out whether or not they want to sign Isaiah Thomas for the long haul when he becomes a free agent, by the time he becomes a free agent next July. I'm not a big fan of Lonzo Ball. I think that this guy has flop written all over him. And even if his dad wasn't the cretin that he was, I'd say the same thing. I think to me, when I look at the three or five best players in this draft, you know, you range, you know, try to take a guesstimation as to how good these guys will be. I think Markelle Fultz is number one. I think Jonathan Isaac of Florida State is number two. And at number three, I think it's going to be Jason Tatum of Duke as the number three guy. Number four, Harry Giles was a guy that a lot of people thought would be transcendent before the knee injury slowed him down. He only played 1 year at Duke, you know, showed that flash of those flashes of potential. But he's probably a late lottery pick or maybe slides out of the lottery. But to me, you know, whoever ends up with Harry Giles could possibly end up with a potential superstar.
All right, that's it. I hate talking NBA, but I had to ask you about Markelle Fultz because obviously the Celtics had him and now they obviously lost him. Thanks, Bernstein Williams. Have a great weekend, man.
All right, thanks a lot, my friend.
All right, that's our program for today. We covered the closer report in short and quick fashion. Then we covered the waiver wire and all the other fantasy baseball content that you could possibly imagine for the remainder of the program. I'd like to thank George Kurtz at George Kurtz on Twitter for coming on and talking about the closer situation across the league, and Brandon C. Williams at BCWilliams71 on Twitter talking about the waiver wire report, which included some closers, and also even brought us a little bit of NBA draft talk, even though that's not all that fantasy relevant. You know, I get my selfishness in there. I need some of my information from my guys, so when I get people who know stuff, I pump them for it. I'm not embarrassed or afraid to admit that. When I want something and I have somebody who has it, I push them and I get it. So from time to time, you guys have to put up with that. But if you want to follow me, Chris Mitchell, on Twitter, at CJMitch73. If you want to talk sports with me on Facebook, it's a podcast to be named later, as well as the RotoExperts.com Fantasy Sports Show. You can read some of my content over at MinorLeagueBall.com, as well as RotoExperts.com. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Be good, be safe, and be warm.